Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're starting our chronological account of the urban history of England today, and we're going to be moving slowly because it is a fascinating topic. We're going to be moving slowly because many of us actually live in towns, and I want to be able for people to feel that their type of town is covered well. And we're going to be moving slowly because, unfortunately, we are in the midst, not just here, but in other countries, of an election campaign. And it's good to remind people that there are other ways of looking at the past, other ways of looking at the present and the future, and something of an antidote to the standard fare. So here goes. But I will begin with a bleak account. And the bleak account is not that of politics, but the bleak account of urban life as revealed in an excavation in 1987 of the churchyard of St. Margaret's Fybridge in Norwich. 436 cadavers were removed, or remains were removed. In use from about 1200 to 1486, the cemetery yielded evidence of privation, pain, and limited physical capacity. Many of the skeletons showed injuries, they showed people that had been malnourished, etc. Now, of course, this was part of the town that was poor and others were not. Nevertheless, the evidence from these skeletons could have been repeated right across the urban landscape, shown, for example, by the analysis of the over 10,000 skeletons from the graveyard of St. Mary's Spittle in London, buried in the mid-13th century, probably as a result of famine. Now, it's true that famine didn't get the wealthy, but the wealthy also suffered much from the hazards as well as the general nature of life, even if one of their standard characteristics was greater weight. And this absence of malnutrition does not necessarily mean that those who are wealthy in urban areas had a completely different lifestyle. They were also subject to many of the problems of life in the past. So I think that's in the background as we think now about the chronology. We start, in my view, with the Bronze Age. The Bronze Age in England began in about 2500 to 2000 BCE and lasted till about 800 BCE when it was replaced by the Iron Age. And during that period, there was a clear shift from nomadism, you know, shifting cultivation and hunting, to a process of settlement and farming. It's true that some scholars have suggested this development was even earlier, for example, in the Neolithic Age, but it was certainly present in the Bronze Age. And the increased permanence of larger settlements has been linked to the development of trading routes, for example, along the Middle Thames, and to related commercial networks. Clearly, that created the possibility settlements created the possibility for town life. And as we talked about last week, it's not as though there's some clear litmus moment in which people say, you know, we've passed the category for a town. But as a different and related process, there is also increased evidence of fortifications, which again suggest a fixity of settlement, and notably of defended hilltop settlements, although there's considerable debate as to whether these places were permanent settlements or places that people could take refuge in. The lack of water on many hilltops suggests that they weren't permanent, but on the other hand, the extent to which many riverbanks and riverbank settlements, therefore, would have been threatened by seasonal flooding would have encouraged people to settle higher up. And what's also the case is that defensive enclosures were not all on hilltops. There was, for example, an Iron Age one at Abingdon. Again, an area in the Middle Thames an area which was an important part for early transport, which were an early trade, which we were talking about in a previous series, and therefore that would have encouraged settlement. Now, during the Iron Age, which began, as I've said, in about 800, the population of England rose and agriculture improved in the sense of become greater amounts being produced. In a related process, by the time of the first Roman attacks and Julius Caesar's attacks were 55 and 54, proto-towns, larger and more complex settlements, and what one might think of as tribal states with chieftain patterns of tribal organisation and populations for individual states in their tens of thousands, these all came to exist in southern England. The extent to which we can call them towns is a matter of opinion or rather debate. They were known to the Romans as oppida, and I think it's fair to say they probably can be seen as towns, although that's not the same thing as saying that Iron Age England had developed an urban civilization. There are certainly the problems posed for us by the nature and interpretation of the archaeological record, as well as by the need to rely for literary sources on Roman material. And that, of course, has its problems in that it can consider things as only really as reaching an urban settlement by Roman definitions, if those are the definitions that appear so to the Romans. Late Iron Age oppida certainly in some cases became the site of Roman cities, and then places that had urban characteristics. And one could see that in the case of Chichester, Silchester, Colchester, and possibly Canterbury and St Albans, to use, of course, their later names. These would have been different, at least to a degree, to the imposed towns established by the Romans at locations that had previously not been oppida. Focusing on these imposed towns rather than on towns as emerging as markets for rural hinterland, Roman towns in England essentially served political and military purposes, indeed on a pattern that was more significant for urban history, English and non-English, than is sometimes allowed. And one can think here of the parallels in a way with some aspects of imperial settlement in the 17th and 18th and 19th century, for example, Chinese settlement in Sinkien. Now, in contrast to the situation in southern England, relatively low populations and a poorly developed agricultural base in both northern England and in Wales, Scotland and Ireland ensured that there was only a small surplus of wealth there to support urban life. Nevertheless, for the Romans, who after all were operating in accordance with their own prospectus, in northern as much as in southern England, the Romans very much brought a new intensity in urban activity, one highlighted by the limited development of towns in northern Europe outside the Roman world. I mean, it's worth saying that clearly the Romans were linked to the urban development of this area, because you only need to go beyond the areas occupied by the Romans to see that there was very little of which we would consider urban life in those areas. Roman forts in England proved the basis for a number of towns, such as Carlisle, Chester, Exeter, Lincoln and York, as well as for less successful towns, such as Great Casterton, while Colchester, Lincoln and Gloucester developed as towns for veterans. The military basis, or at least context, for early Roman urban settlement was clear in 60, when the Iceni rose under their ruler Boudica and destroyed the major Roman settlements, which were then Colchester, St Albans and London, only to be totally defeated soon after. Yet the military origins could be very short term, for towns that were legionary fortresses could swiftly lose this function. So Exeter was founded by the Romans as a legionary base for the Second Augusta. That's the name of the legion under Vespasian. But it quickly ceased to be a legionary fortress. The legion was moved to South Wales, where its base was Caerleon. But nevertheless, Exeter continued going and remained, in fact, a town of consequence. During the Roman period, which lasted until 409, the administrative hierarchy and military system was not unchanging. But the major towns nevertheless remain significant, albeit with differing emphases. Rectilinear grid street patterns centered on forums and basilicas developed in these towns, and the surviving engineering is impressive. In York, which became the capital of the province of Northern Roman Britain, Britannia Inferior, the Roman sewer in Church Street was made of huge millstone grit blocks and was used to serve the legionary bath buildings nearby. Ironically, perhaps, but also as an example of the significance of these towns, the Emperor Septimius Severus died of disease at York in 211 after invading Scotland. Some towns, usually now with Chester in their name, emerged alongside fortresses, but others developed apparently as a result of initiatives by native elites that were keen to adopt Roman culture and material life. Indeed, writing of the 70s and 80s, the Roman historian Tacitus, who was the son-in-law of the provincial governor Agricola, noted that the Britons, quote, spoke of such novelties as civilization when really they were only a feature of enslavement. Nevertheless, whatever his skepticism, the British elite wanted to take part in Roman activity. Whatever their origin, towns were centres of authority, of trade, of consumption, and of Roman culture, including eventually Christianity. The last Christianity succeeded the Olympian cults, that of Mithras, and local cults, for example, at Bath, in many urban locations. Towns were in practice arranged in networks of government and economics. Thus, in the rural hinterland of London, supplies for it were organised by the smaller towns of the region, such as Brentwell, Ewell, and Staines. And for these and other purposes, roads linked towns. Thus, from London, Watling Street went to Chester and Dover, Ermine Street to York, and Staines Street to Chichester. At the same time, Chester, Gloucester, Lincoln, London, and York were also river ports, while the Romans' presence was ultimately dependent on maritime links to the continent, links that were important to the development of London and the Kent ports of Dover and Richborough, from which the first stage of Watling Street ran to London. London itself was established by the Romans at a strategic location on the north bank of the Thames, which, as in the case of most rivers, was much wider than today, remaining so until the embankments built from the mid-19th century onwards, when major rivers were in effect canalised. Moreover, the river was tidal to where the Romans built London. The low gravel banks of the north bank provided north well-drained firmness for construction and also a good site for the first bridge across the Thames. And of course, so many of these towns were important as bridging points, or at the very least as ferry points, and whichever was the case, as the lowest bridging point or ferrying point. So you can see that, for example, London. You can see that with Chester, you can see it with York, you can see it with Exeter. So what you've therefore got is the linkage of a river route or a maritime route with a road route. And that's certainly the basis for all of the towns that I've already spoken upon. Different to the other major centres in Rome and Britain in being the leading port, London nevertheless was not one of the foremost provincial towns of the empire, like Lyon or Trier. In part, this was because Rome, Britain's economic and demographic weight in the empire was less than that of France or Spain, or the Rhine frontier. Nevertheless, as a town of considerable scale, London had large buildings as well as a very large forum, and it would have impressed contemporaries who had only been used to seeing smaller towns at that period. There was also, as of course was characteristic of urban life, variations in land use by function and fashion, by commerce and manufacturing within that particular urban area, and indeed within other urban areas. Now, these variations were often dependent on external links, as in the sense of this is close to where the bridgehead was, this is close to where the road to the east ran, that kind of thing. But they were also linked to the possibilities of the site and the topography of each site, slope features, river features, marshland, et cetera, varied enormously. For London, as in for other Roman towns, there was building in stone, but much more was cheaply built under timber, which was available locally, and out of mud brick. This was a way to respond to the number of settlers, although, despite the relative ease of building, I mean, in those forms, nevertheless, most people lived in small and crowded houses and thus in dirty and noisy towns. Furthermore, that was part of what you see more generally, you see it to this day, a tension between town life and quality life, one that was particularly acute in periods when numbers rose. So, for example, the drains of Roman London couldn't re readily cope with the need for sanitation. Now, that's a recurrent problem. Obviously, the evidence for it is much greater, shall we say, for the early 19th century than for the 3rd century. But nevertheless, we shouldn't therefore imagine that in the 3rd century it wasn't an issue. London remained important throughout the period of Roman rule. Certainly it was the capital in the 4th century, the sole mint, and therefore the centre of liquidity. But the archaeological record is patchy by the 4th century. But yet at the same time, finds of coins minted in Roman London are quite common, testifying to its relatively high profile within the empire and the extent to which its economy was integrated with the rest of the empire. Now, that's very much the case with the southeast of England and therefore with its towns. It is probably far less the case with, shall we say, the Roman impact in what is now northwest England. So, when one's thinking of Roman towns and indeed Roman England as a whole, one should be prepared to accept that there was geographical variation. Obviously, the notion of an empire is that the rule of the empire, emperor, and of imperial governance was equal at every point, but that was not the case. It's been argued that towns themselves became to a degree irrelevant in the 4th century, as the economy of Roman England, Roman Britain, declined, with much of the native population possibly treating them as marginal. And this analysis suggests that it was not the barbarian invasions alone that put paid to Roman Britain and Roman towns. Instead, the collapse of the Roman tax state in part involved the unravelling of relations between towns and a countryside that had scant need for them, and that it was increasingly not producing the wherewithal to enable towns to operate to the potential they might have sought. Anyway, the end of the Roman Empire in Britain, which was 409 to 410, did not initially mean the end of Roman Britain. Saint Germanus, the Bishop of Auxerre in France, who visited in 429, noted the survival of towns, but he also noted that their defence was in local hands rather than those of Roman troops. It's possible that a major cause of instability in the 5th century was that the inhabitants of the more upland areas, the ones that were less Romanized in the civil sense, retained much more idea of fighting and using weapons in their own traditional ways, and therefore found the Romanized lowlanders very easy victims once imperial power was withdrawn. These lowlanders indeed may have been identified as separate peoples on the basis of late Roman town territories, or the process of identification and organization may have involved a more inchoate situation, and one maybe ought to be thinking about the development of what in effect were war bands. At any rate, whatever the extent of earlier dissolution, the barbarian conquests of the 5th, 6th, and 17th and 7th centuries certainly brought change. It's true that there's continuity of site use at some of the major towns, as suggested anyway by archaeology, for example, at Canterbury, an urban building continued into the 6th century at some, for example, Roxter, but a reliance on wood ensured that there are few remains of buildings from the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries. And therefore, it's not particularly easy for us to establish what was going on in this period. Certainly, archaeological techniques were long relatively limited. Remains in cities were affected by later building work, by the destruction of archaeological material in centuries of cellaring, digging down under buildings. And it's only really when you get the large-scale funding of rescue archaeology by developers in London and elsewhere from the 1970s that prospects improve and that we start to have a better idea, partly of Roman towns and partly also in the 2000s produced finds from the early Saxon period of the late 6th or 7th century, and showed that there was a significant town there to the west of what had been Roman London. It's probable that more work will produce additional valuable finds, suggesting that the apparent abandonment of towns was less intense or less long than had been envisaged. On the other hand, the substance of urban life certainly changed. So, you know, people might well have been still living in towns, but it might have been very much a question of people living, as it were, in a different way, certainly without the extensive trade networks, to the same extent at any rate, that had existed. So, for example, the nature of animal and plant remains, which have been shown by archaeology, has revealed that in contrast to the Roman period, gardens and orchards for subsequent centuries, they left less evidence. Ceramics came to be locally produced rather than traded in and of lower quality. And stone was often no longer quarried, but simply removed from existing buildings, or cannibalized, if you like. Cross-sections of towns, of the archaeological record in towns, certainly suggest clear evidence of discontinuities in settlement in places like Exeter, for example. And indeed, Anglo-Saxon rulers initially did not live within the Roman town walls. Trade was of limited importance, and there was a focus on subsistence agriculture. The relevance of towns and town life in this period was limited, and the extent to which England was invariably going to follow a pattern of urban significance comparable to France, Spain, or Italy is unclear. Certainly, there's far less evidence for urban activity in 5th and 6th century England than for France. It's significant that relatively little is known of London in the 5th or 6th century. After all, London was, or had been, the largest town. And the contradictions between written sources and archaeological evidence, both of which are fragmentary, are also telling. The Roman town seems to have been substantially deserted, with the centre of remaining settlement moving west along the banks of the Thames and also inland towards the Strand and Covent Garden, the new Saxon centre of Ludenwijk, a settlement that was close to the countryside, of which it was very much part, and which didn't have the same size, sophistication, differentiation or commercial links of Roman London. And it's likely that the same could be said of other towns for the period. Yet, it's worth bearing in mind that expansion can follow contraction, as very differently was to be shown in the 16th century with recovery from the long-term impact of the Black Death. So there was a revival in both Christianity and the volume of trade, and each of those brought an increase in activity, certainly in Ludwig, or London, if you like, in the 7th century. This increase drew on the energy and wealth of the East Anglian and Kentish royal dynasties, and also on the developing importance of renewed links with the continent. At the beginning of the 7th century, a church dedicated to St. Paul was established in London as the seat of the bishop for the East Saxons, who dominated Essex and Middlesex. Like many other early Saxon churches, the first St. Paul's was sited within the former Roman town, in this instance on top of Ludgate Hill, the height of which today it's easy to overlook, but actually if you walk it, you can see it more clearly. Small and built of timber, this church burned down in 675 before being rebuilt, again in timber, which was plentiful then in the region. Now, London itself wasn't a key political settlement centre, because it wasn't the capital of one of the Anglo-Saxon states. And, you know, there's some difference as to why it therefore developed. Was it adept at playing off the different kingdoms? Was it the case that despite a relative lack of sponsorship, its role as a port remained, and therefore it was a key focus of land and water routes? It's certainly the case that of the other towns in the region, Canterbury lacked London's commercial role and was affected anyway by the decline of the Kentish kingdom. Norwich was an important commercial centre, but wasn't so well placed, not least for external trade. Moreover, whatever the political consequences, London's role as a frontier town on the borders of several kingdoms and sub-kingdoms provided an opportunity for interstate trade. Christianity, meanwhile, had helped revive urban purpose, since there was a need for diocesan centres for bishoprics, places where the bishop would have their seat. For the church very much followed a town-based organisation. You know, there is obviously monasticism in the church, and there is obviously hermits, both of whom are very different in their geographical specifications. But essentially, the church followed this town-based organisation. It's interesting to consider what might have been the case had it not done so. Anyway, church centres included Canterbury, Rochester, London, Winchester, Sherborne, Hereford, Worcester, Lichfield, York, Hexham, Dunwich, Caistor, and Leicester. Pope Gregory, and of those, all bar Dunwich and Caistor, are still major centres. Pope Gregory had intended two archiepiscopal sees at London and at York, each with 12 bishoprics. Now, we could argue that that's probably a legacy from the Roman Empire. They would have obviously heard of London in Rome. But this didn't match political realities. Instead, it was a result of the influence of Athelbert, King of Kent, in supporting the conversion mission of St. Augustine, that Canterbury, his capital, was the see of the archbishop. But it's also worth noting that Athelbert also backed Augustine in establishing bishoprics at London and Rochester, serving a religious purpose but helping bind these towns to his kingdom. In turn, York, which was the centre of the Kingdom of Northumbria, gained archiepiscopal status in 735, while later in the 8th century, King Offa of Mercia sought to have the Mercian see, Lichfield, given archiepiscopal equality with Canterbury and York, although without lasting effect. Aside from bishoprics, there were also minsters, such as Leominster, Southwell and Stratford-on-Avon. These were ecclesiastical centres, in part mission centres, that became the basis for important towns. Now, in the case of individual religious foundations, where they were located reflected the topography of towns and in turn helped define their townscapes. Churches were long the individual largest building and most dominant building within the walls. And as in Winchester, the location of churches within towns was the result of particular topographies, the layout physically of the town, and also changes in the location of towns could reflect that. Urban layout was of significance for the structural stability of buildings, for the continuity of neighbourhoods, for drainage, for defence, and also for the more general value of the town as a setting for power and governance. More generally, urban design, including the possibilities for ceremonial entries and passages, affected the street grid and the layout of buildings. The coalescence of smaller kingdoms into larger ones also provided a need for capitals, in a sense, a hierarchy among towns, a basis in the royal and governmental presence for political protection for towns. But protection could only go so far. Work on a fossilised human stool discovered in 1972 has indicated the unhealthy nature of life in York in about 950, with the inhabitants who produced this stool clearly having a limited diet and evidence of a large number of intestinal worms. So that is a reality rather like the skeletons I mentioned at the outset. But I don't want to close on excrement. Let me instead close by looking forward, and that is considering the small number of leading ports that developed spectacularly in the 8th century, with in a sense more potential than Lichfield was to show as an archiepiscopal centre. So one's thinking here of Ipswich, of London, of Sandwich, of Southampton and York. Coastal and overseas trade became more regular. Southampton, which may have been planned by King Inna of Wessex, who ruled from 688 to 726, is estimated to have covered 111 acres, that's a large area, and was a major centre of trade and minting. These emporia, commercial emporia, made sense in terms of trade networks that included continental trading towns, for example, the Danish town on the west coast of Jutland of Ribe, R-I-B-E. The pre-Viking settlement at Ipswich, a new settlement, eventually covered around 50 hectares. Here, the River Orwell combined with the North Sea, more specifically the southern part of the North Sea, to provide important links. And the earlier foundation of Ipswich, probably in the early 7th century, may well have been intended to provide resources for the East Anglian dynasty, as well as encouraging commercial links with the continent. At the same time, whilst archaeological finds can be really helpful, that doesn't always explain the reasons for change. So in Ipswich, the causes and stages of urban settlement invite discussion that by its nature is far from conclusive. And I think it's fair to say that that is true for all towns in that period. There can be a tendency for people to want answers that are not always readily possible, partly because of the nature of the evidence and partly because of the nature of the problem. Anyway, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. Many issues one could pick up on. But I want to just start by asking a little bit more about the role of fortification and particularly of of walls going around towns and cities. In the Roman period of erecting walls, are we generally just talking about the most major urban centres like London, York, Colchester, which would have been entirely circled by walls? Or does the archaeological evidence suggest that most towns had some form of perimeter wall of some kind?
Well, fortifications are not quite always the same as walls. I mean, those that were most fortified were centres of government and places with military garrisons. But pretty well everywhere would have had a means of delimiting the urban space, in part to keep out animals, which was an important factor, in part to mark a governmental boundary between the town and what was outside the town. So I think one can fairly say yes to walls as long as you don't expect too much from them.
Right, I see. And my second question is about street layout. There's an impression one always has with Roman towns that they develop along a grid-style street platform. Not exactly so, but often so. When the Anglo-Saxons took over these Roman settlements, did they abandon this grid street network in order to create different, slightly less angular lines, or did they just maintain them and they started to be broken up later in the medieval period?
Right. Can I just I'll answer that in a second. Can I just go back to my previous one? I ought to make it clear that to listeners that the Roman period is not a unity, and that in the 3rd and 4th century, I think particularly after a series of, as I say, I use the term barbarian without being pejorative, but particularly after a series of barbarian attacks just before the mid-3rd century, it became the case that more settlements had walls. The same thing is also the case in Gaul, or we would call it France. So one should be wary of assuming that there's a unitary answer, because there was more need to defend places, and also linked to that, you get more of a concern with not just, as it were, being attacked from the land, but also being attacked from the water. And classically, you get the forts of the so-called Saxon shore, but also you get in London, for example, a concern with its fortification on the Thames side. Now, as far as your second point is concerned about rectilinear or grid systems, well, first of all, I think it's worth saying that rectilinear and grid systems under the Romans were most pronounced in, as it were, the ceremonial and governmental centres of the town, ceremonial, religious, of course, and governmental centres. And one shouldn't assume that they were found at all points of the urban space. And the Romans, as with their roads, and you may recall we were talking about their roads, just as their roads could adapt to the topography, so the same thing with roads within towns. Having said that, there was more standardisation in the Roman case than what was to come with the Anglo-Saxons. Now, if we're looking at the so-called vic towns, you know, these trading towns I'm talking about towards the close. No, they're not laid out necessarily in a pattern that we are talking about with the Roman case, not least because there wasn't, from what we can see, a equivalent to a potent authority controlling the land and deploying military resources, as in the initial layout of Roman settlements. But also, there wasn't necessarily the same cultural value attached. I mean, the cultural value attached within Anglo-Saxon settlements would have been much more to do, as in Winchester, with the location of churches particularly the chief church, and therefore with the route to the church from the major town gate, and also with the residences of the ruler, in the case of Winchester, the ruler of Wessex, and also of the bishop. Now, that doesn't require a systematized nature of the entire urban space. So I don't think one should be planning to imagine that you would get that. Clearly, as we know, we'll talk about it when we come to it. You get some Anglo-Saxon settlements known as burhs, B-U-R-H-S, which are fortress-based in most cases, not all cases, and they would have been more designed for fortress pattern, and that tends to have a degree of regularity. But again, topography trumps everything. You know, you have to take advantage of slopes. You have to close vulnerabilities, and those are more significant than, as it were, if you're designing a town on an isotropic plane where every point is of equal height, which is not the case with England.
No, it certainly isn't. Well, I'd like to explore this more, but we'll have to do so further next time when we move from Saxon towns through to the Norman period. But for taking us from the Roman period through the interregnum and then into the Dark Ages, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.